Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 15th of August, 1995, and in the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jeff Dwyer, and the session that he will be doing is called Aging and Family Relationships. So, let's listen in on Jeff.
I'm really hopeful that we can make this a week-long experience that's largely interactive and discussion-oriented, but I do have some information that I want to present that I hope will spark some of that discussion, and I think your experiences and understanding and knowledge will have a great deal to do with what we get out of this week. Let me perhaps introduce myself a little more completely so that you're clear about what I am not. Full-time job, what I spend my life doing is I'm director of the Institute of Gerontology at Wayne State University, which is a major research university. I spend my life either doing research on aging-related issues or being responsible in an administrative sense for people who are doing similar kinds of things. And one of the things that I look forward to this week is what that experience has allowed me to do is to come in contact with a lot of information that I think we have kept to ourselves in academic environments and haven't talked enough to people in general about. And I think some of those things we all need to understand. As I mentioned, I would prefer that this be as highly interactive as possible. So at any point that you have questions or concerns or ideas related to things I'm saying, I would very much appreciate that you do that. It's also important for you to know that I'm not a real doc. I'm not an MD, I'm a PhD, so that while I may talk about specific health conditions and things like that, if you have prostate cancer, I don't know anything about it. Or if you have other clinical medical problems, I don't know anything about it. Nevertheless, part of the point that I want to be able to make throughout this week is that we don't need to be clinicians, we don't necessarily need to be MDs, we don't need to be PhDs, we don't need to have anybody with any academic training to start to understand what some aging-related issues are that affect all of us. That's the reason I titled today Aging and Family Relationships, because there's nothing magic about a chronological age that we typically associate with old age. And in fact, in a few moments, I'll try and indicate to you how relatively arbitrary and haphazard old age policy in this country has been, and maybe this is a good time for us to start thinking about what a more sensible old age policy would be. But given that it's been relatively haphazard, and perhaps we haven't kept up with the needs to the extent that we should, we have created some problems for ourselves. And that's why I've titled today Aging and Family Relationships, because the issues that we're talking about today and will continue throughout the week are not about issues that affect only people 65 and older. But in fact, they're issues that affect people at any age because they know people who are 65 and older. But as I'll try and make the point later in the hour today, even if you think specifically about healthcare issues, there's nothing magic or there's no necessary relationship between any healthcare problem and older chronological ages. And in fact, many of the healthcare problems that are most often associated with older chronological ages have their beginnings at very young ages in life. So for example, and I'll get to this point later on, but for example, one out of three women over the age of 55 suffer from some form of urinary incontinence. So we think of it in terms of it being an older age, older chronological age problem. But for most of those women, that problem began in their 20s in childbearing, because that's the point where physiologically some things begin to occur that come home to roost, so to speak, later on. So a lot of what I want to talk about is that this is really a lifelong set of issues and that it's not something attached specifically to chronological age, although some of what I'm going to be talking about today, I use chronological age because that's the way our public policy is oriented. Okay? I'd like to start with a little bit of an example because, in my view, a lot of what we have to think about and talk about and be concerned about with respect to aging-related issues has to do with access and utilization. We have one of the best, if not the best, healthcare systems in the world in the United States, and yet, as many of you are aware from the healthcare debates of the last couple of years and the contract with America that's seeking to make some changes, perhaps try to make some changes in Medicare and Medicaid, There's a great deal of discussion going on with respect to aging-related policy, which has to do with access and utilization. And one of the things I want to try and make clear is that, like so many other social problems, just even here this week, people are talking about immigration. People in the past at Holden and other places have talked about homelessness. Certainly, there's often a great deal of discussion, as there just was in one of the previous sessions, on marriage and family relationships. But I would argue, and one of the things I will try and passionately pursue this week, is that there may be no social issue of greater importance to us now and in the next few decades than the aging-related issues, that some of which I want to talk about today, both because of demographic reasons, just sheer size, but also because of the impact that it has on so many different people, including in ways that you may not think about. For example, one of the resource materials that is available for you, actually free, focuses on aging-related implications in areas including the environment. What does it mean to have a rapidly increasing older chronological age population, and what are we going to have to do to meet their needs, and what is that going to force us to do with respect to our environment? And so there's a lot of things that we might want to talk about in some of these areas as we go on. But I want to start with an example to indicate to you how, if we don't sort of open our minds to the complexity of some of these issues and the broad impact of some of these issues, sometimes we might really miss the point. Can some of you, will be able to note a major event that occurred in the world, actually, but I think in the United States it was a particular issue, as it was to England, in 1912?
I don't even know!
It wasn't a war, it wasn't any of that sort of thing, but it was a significant single event that really impacted a lot of people, both because they were involved in various ways, but also because there was sort of a psychic component to it in terms of where people placed their trust and what they expected from technology and all of those sorts of things.
Is there an epidemic?
No. Well, actually, there was an epidemic just following that, the flu epidemic, but that took millions of people. I'm thinking in terms of a single event that really took in the neighborhood of, I think, about 1,500 people.
Sinking of the Titanic?
The sinking of the Titanic. Oh. Now, if you're asking yourself, what does the sinking of the Titanic have to do with aging?
I'm not going tired.
Thanks for trying. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to get this so we won't get bumped on it over and over again.
Thank you very much. The sinking of the Titanic was an important event, because it was believed to be the unsinkable ship. It was a ship that had all of the world's best technology in it. It was really the ship that was going to make the crossing of the Atlantic something of great ease. In fact, when it hit the iceberg, it was a terrible event, and what most of us know about it is a lot of people died. What I want to show you here in this chart, to the extent that it deals with access and utilization, that we also need to think about not just single events, but we need to think about the lifelong opportunities that people have available to them or that they pursue for a whole variety of reasons that may have their impact in a single event. So on the Titanic, what I'm going to fill in here and what the numbers represent on the bottom of the chart, this is this percentage, 24.1%, represents the death rate among females on the Titanic. So there were 415 females on the Titanic, and 100 of them died. This example works from 1912 in a way that it might not work today, because as you probably know, the Titanic didn't have enough lifeboats, so virtually all of the men died, but it was an era of women and children first, so the men pretty much did die. I'm not sure that would work so well today. But one of the things, this is about what we know about the Titanic. A lot of people died. And even if you look at the death rate among females, which is probably the best thing to look at in terms of access and utilization, a context where there weren't enough lifeboats and all of those sorts of things, about 1 in 4 die. But there's a very interesting thing about the Titanic, that this first, second, and third I have here is cabin class. In first class, there were 143 women, 4 died. 2.8%. And at least, I'm not a Titanic expert, but the books say that at least two of those women made a choice not to get into a boat.
Stayed with their husbands.
Stayed with their husbands. I don't know about the other two. In second class, there were 93 women, 15 of whom died, 16.1%. And by now, when you see this number, you can probably see that of the 179 women in the total population in third class, 81 died for 45.2%. And I like to use this example because while it doesn't have anything to do with aging per se, what it does is suggest that here is a single event that had a very bad outcome for many, many people. But there clearly were differences in terms of who had what opportunities. Moreover, the differences in terms of who had what opportunities weren't just specific to the Titanic. In other words, you could afford first class steerage or third class steerage because of a whole lifelong history of things that occurred that had to do with your economic ability to purchase a specific ticket. In other words, we sometimes look at things as if, you know, we look at people and the choices that they make and we say to ourselves, why did they do that? Or that was really a silly thing to do, or there were a lot better choices for them to make. But we need to begin to understand that people, because of their life histories and the experiences that they've had, have different sets of choices. So it's not as if anyone in third class, when they were going to buy their ticket for the Titanic, said to themselves, should I get first class or third class? And chose third class. They chose third class because that's all that they could afford. And in fact, it had a great deal to do with their outcome on the Titanic. I try not to push this analogy too far, but I think all of you can probably think in your own lives about people of older chronological ages, perhaps not as fortunate as you and I are economically and otherwise, or in terms of our families, an issue I want to get to in a few minutes. But people who, for example, in our excellent healthcare system, we tend to generally assume that the healthcare needs of older people, in this context meaning 65 and older, are taken care of because we have Medicare for them. But how many of you know people who are unable to afford the approximately $800 or $900 copayment for Medicare Part B? I certainly do.
You do? Or the medications.
Well, and because they don't get Medicare Part B, they don't get the medication.
They don't get medications even on Medicare Part B.
Well, without a copay, right?
Well, without anything. Medicare Part B covers no medications whatsoever. And many of the elderly people have a great deal of difficulty paying for medications.
That's right.
Other people may be able to afford.
So that there are many people who don't have the economic resources, and yet as a general public we assume we have Medicare, everybody's taken care of, and we have these problems. One of the things I want to try and point out that we may not get to today, actually Thursday's discussion will probably be more oriented toward this, is that there are tremendous differences in the aging population in terms of who's impacted by the issues that we're going to talk about. So for example, when you talk about aging-related issues or aging chronological age-related problems, you're really talking about a set of issues that predominantly affect women rather than men, for a whole variety of reasons. Even within that, you're talking about a whole set of issues that predominantly affect women of color more than they do Caucasian women. And so there are, just as a little bit of background, I'm trying to communicate that this is a set of issues that impacts us in a number of different ways and impacts different people in decidedly different ways. Let me just erase this very quickly. Does anybody know how many people over the age of 65 there are in the United States today?
Is that 40 million?
Well, close, 33 million. I'm just going to draw a line here. About 12.5% of the population is over the age of 65. Any guess at how many of those are in nursing homes?
Less than 10%.
Less than 10, right?
Maybe less than 5.
Actually, it's about 5. About 1.7 million are in nursing homes. what's interesting about this is that this is a snapshot in time. So that today, about 5% of the over 65 population is in a nursing home. But over the course of time, from the time that people reach age 65, about 1 in 4 will spend some time in a nursing home. And for those of you, are any of you physicians or nurses or?
Nurse.
Okay. One of the things that becomes, I'll try and bring up some specific examples as we go along, one of the things that becomes an issue when we begin to understand that it's not just 1 in 20, but 1 in 5, 1 in 4 actually, that will spend some time in a nursing home, is that one of the greatest impacts on the functioning of an older person who is already beginning to have some functioning impairments is time spent in an acute care hospital or a nursing home. They're there for a reason. They're there because they have an acute problem or a semi-chronic problem that needs to be taken care of. But we've not done a good job in this country of maintaining their functioning while they're in those environments. So there's story after story after story of someone going into a hospital for an angioplasty or some other relatively, these days, simple procedure that we know they're likely to come out of, but because they spend 7 or 10 days in a hospital where no one's moving limbs, they're not getting up and walking, they come out and they're not able to function as they did before. So these kinds of concerns are concerns. Does anybody have a guess at how many people are in the community, living in the community, not in a nursing home, but require some sort of assistance?
Another 3%?
Actually, it's quite a bit more than that. It's about another 8 million people.
Woo!
And that's a fact that most of us don't know. If you break this 8 million down, and it depends on whose study you look at, but it's not unreasonable to maybe cut this in half and to say that about 4 million are what's known as ADL impaired, and about 4 million are what's known as IADL impaired. ADL impairments are activities of daily living. So do any of you have a long-term care policy? Do you? If you remember on that long-term care policy, it probably says that the policy begins to provide you benefits at either 2 or 3 activity of daily living impairments. Activity of daily living impairments are measured by whether you are able to go to the bathroom on your own, whether you are able to feed yourself, whether you are able to walk around inside your home without assistance, and things like that. So about 1 in 8 of this number is not in a nursing home, in the community, but needs significant amounts of help in order for them to function on a daily basis. Instrumental activities of daily living are really a different character in that activity of daily living are tasks that need to occur essentially daily. I mean, you need to eat, you need to be able to move around, those sorts of things. Instrumental activity of daily living tasks are things like shopping, running errands, paying your bills, things like that, that don't require, they're just a different class of activity. They're certainly important, and they're certainly things that need to be accomplished, but they aren't the kind of necessary daily kinds of tasks that are associated with activity of daily living tasks. So this is fully about 1 in 4 people over the age of 65 are in the community but require some form of assistance. Now, this makes for an awfully bad picture, and this is where we need to always keep the other part in mind, and that is to say that that means that about 23 million people over the age of 65, like many people here at Holden this week, are incredible contributors to society in many, many different ways, are active, are healthy, are doing the things that they wanted to do. We have, some of you may remember the name of an individual named George Romney from Republican politics in the 1960s. He was the governor of Michigan and started to run for president in the 1968 election against Nixon. He died at the age of 88 2 weeks ago, running on his treadmill at 5 o'clock in the morning. That's literally where his wife found him. Never had arthritis, never to hear people talk about it, never had, in effect, any of the illnesses associated with old age. And that is what many, many, many people experience. So that we always have to keep this thing in mind, that for most, aging is a wonderful thing, and it has all kinds of benefits that accrue to it in terms of interacting with family and enjoying life without working and all of those sorts of things. But even this is disproportionately experienced by people who are middle or upper middle class and tend to be white as opposed to some person of color. Any questions so far? I just want to provide a little bit of background as far as that goes. Okay, let me just give you a little bit of additional information to try and cement for you why I think these are concerns for us. Right now, conservative estimates suggest that this 33 million people will double to about 65 million in the next 50 years. Those are conservative estimates. That would make the population 65 and older about 25% of the population.
That's all the baby boomers retire.
Well, the baby boomers will kick in. Actually, the trend in growth of the 65-plus population will be a little slower than it has been until about 2010 or 2015, and then the baby boomers start kicking in and drive that population up. Now, that's a conservative estimate. Of course, some people suggest that that number will be vastly higher. But certainly we can expect that in terms of chronological age, that population will go up. An interesting thing in that context is that essentially throughout this century, we've really done a tremendous job of increasing life expectancy for people. That is, how long people can expect to live. But we've done very little in terms of increasing lifespan, which is how long can the oldest person live, which is generally thought to be about 110 years old. There are certainly some reports of people older than that, but it's generally thought to be around 110 years old. So essentially what we're doing is successfully pushing more people closer to what is the longest period of time that any of us are capable of living. Let me for a moment mention just a couple of economic issues, since that's what's been so much on the agenda in the last couple of years and something that we need to talk about here some this week. Currently, about 30% of the federal budget in some form reflects benefits for people age 65 and older. So that would be Medicare, that would be a substantial part of Medicaid, which was originally designed for women and children, but a substantial part of it goes to pay for long-term care for in poverty people over the age of 65. Estimates suggest, and again, conservative estimates, that if we don't make some changes in how we pay for the health and long-term care needs of people age 65 and older, that in the next 50 years, about 60% of the federal budget will be needed only to provide benefits to that group of people. So again, that's why at least there needs to be some discussion about these issues. And by the way, part of this discussion needs to be, we also put a lot of investment in people age 18 and under. So it's not unreasonable to think that this needs to be a fair shake across the board for everybody. And yet I'm not sure that we've adequately addressed those sorts of issues. Right now we spend about $50 billion a year in public funds on nursing homes alone, $50 billion. And about another $50 billion comes out of yours and my pocket for people that we know and love to pay for nursing homes. So that's a big issue as well. Having said all that, and a lot of what I want to talk about a little bit today and then more on Thursday, is that despite all of the expenditures for long-term care, for nursing home and for that functionally impaired group that's still in the community, 80% of long-term care in this country is provided by you and me for our family with essentially no reimbursement. Every now and then there's a new Medicaid waiver or Medicare waiver program that will provide for some out-of-pocket expenses for taking care of an impaired family member. But most of what is taking place in long-term care in this country is being provided by you and me without reimbursement. What's difficult about this, and again, back to the title of today in terms of aging and family relationships, is that certainly I think most of us, probably all of us in this room, but even in general, in the general population in the United States, there's some sense that there is an obligation to take care of our family members when we reach old age. But one of the things, and what I hear frequently, however, is sort of the flip side of that coin, and that is to say that, well, I was able to do thus and such for my parents, but my kids just aren't willing to do that for me. So one of the things that we need to explore this week is that there are different conditions under which people are trying to provide those kinds of resources. Moreover, there are different conditions under which the needs occur. So for example, even 30 or 40 years ago, when somebody needed long-term care, they essentially needed it for a relatively short period of time because they had some sort of acute or semi-chronic condition, and then they die. It didn't last for very long. Today, I'm sure that most of us in this room know people who have been providing significant amounts of care to an older family member, a parent or a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, and have been doing that for years. And those same people who are doing that are now also trying to work full-time and do other sorts of things that make it very, very difficult. So one of the things I've been looking forward to this week is an opportunity to interact with you and to talk with you, because I think as academics we can go through these numbers and we can say, wow, this is a really big problem. It would be nice to do something about it. But to understand the real impact and how to communicate that impact. And I think that one of the things I have had the greatest concern about is that these are not a set of issues that churches in particular seem to be spending a great deal of time on. Now, certainly there are exceptions to that. But in last spring when I was putting together some material for this week, I went to three different Christian bookstores, pretty big Christian bookstores, and there were aisles full of marriage and family stuff. There were aisles full of child stuff. There were aisles that were some combination of homelessness, poverty, that sort of thing. I couldn't find one book that had to do, other than there were readings, there were Bible passages for, how some of those are for kids or for adults or for older age people. There were those kinds of books, but there were no books of the sort that we are now more frequently seeing with respect to other social issues. And I think it's something that we need to think about and to talk about. Let me tell you quickly what my goals are for this week. One is that we have the opportunity collectively to share some information that I hope will be helpful. And I hope that after I finish this mini speech, that you, if you have questions or concerns or even problems that you're individually struggling with, that you will raise those and that we can talk about those. Because those, what you will find this week is that those will be specific examples of more general problems that many of us are experiencing in many different ways. And let me try and give you what some of those examples might be. Some of you may have read in the popular press in the last 2 or 3 months a study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine that said that fully 25% of prescriptions written for people over the age of 65 are wrong. They're not only wrong, in some cases they're deadly. Because we don't have a physician population at this point in time, we're making progress, but we by and large don't have a physician population that's trained to understand the specific needs and physiological responses of people as they reach older chronological ages. And this is a large population-based study found that fully 25% of prescriptions were contraindicated for the geriatric patients that they were being prescribed for. And that's a problem. One way to deal with that is to train more geriatric physicians, most people would argue, and I think we're making some good progress in that regard. But I think another way to do it is for us to begin to understand what these issues are and what kinds of questions we need to ask and how we can maybe take responsibility for some of these things on our own so that we can pursue that. Another study that came out that you might have some questions about is one that suggests that Alzheimer's disease may be something that we're all going to get eventually if we live if we live long enough. And that, I think, is really something to at least pause and think about for a little bit, because I think many of us have experience with family members or friends with Alzheimer's disease and know how devastating it can be, not only for the individual, but also for the people that love them and are trying to take care of them. But I think it's also useful to just know that, for example, the most recent study that came out that said that 50% of people at age 90 will have Alzheimer's disease in some form. Some of it will be early onset. It won't be long-term Alzheimer's, but they will have just acquired it. But that fully 50% of us will have it if we reach age 90. And as a couple of the resources that I have available for you indicate, more and more of us will be reaching that age. And so it's something that we need to think about and know about and to talk about when that is possible. So if you have specific kinds of questions or concerns, I mentioned long-term care policies earlier. Some of us are being pushed by our insurance agents and others, sometimes even family members, to obtain long-term care policies. But one of the things we need to understand about most of those policies is they don't provide you any benefits until you're already very impaired. That doesn't mean that they're not a good thing, but it does mean that you are going to need other kinds of assistance before that policy will kick in and provide for the extensive in-home or nursing home care that you might need. And again, I'll say that I think that this is a time where people who are people concerned with social issues, people in churches who are able to have an impact on how social policy is developed, even within a small community, even a church, that this is an important time to think about some of these issues and to perhaps think through how we might be able to bring about change in our environments in order to meet some of these needs. Friday's discussion, that's what I'd like to focus on. Some of you may come from churches. I know we have a handful in the Detroit area where I'm from that now have full-time nurses on their staff as a way to meet the needs of their congregation. And I think one of the things that might be worth thinking about over time is, do we have a population of individuals within our churches who might require some of the attention of that nurse, or might we be able to take some of our resources and specifically target toward accommodating the needs of older people in our churches in a way that would benefit them? I would, back to my earlier point, that there's nothing about older chronological age in relationship to specific health conditions, and I use the urinary incontinence example. Many of us use the language in our churches of shut-ins or people that we need to go visit because they're homebound or something like that. Well, they're not shut-ins or homebound because they're old. They're shut-ins or homebound because they have some sort of problem that doesn't permit them to come to church or to be active in that environment. And for many, many people, we know that is things like urinary incontinence or other sorts of conditions that can be dealt with in fairly remedial ways, in ways that you and I can teach them, that doesn't require a physician. And so I think there's a lot of work that can be done in that area. And again, the other thing that I would like to try and accomplish as a goal this week is that we think about this as a lifelong experience, that it's not just something that kicks in at age 25, but that it's something that, I'm sorry, age 65. For some of us, it kicks in at age 25. Not just at age 65, but that it's something that we need to be cognizant of and deal with our families with as they not only experience our aging, but as they begin to experience older chronological ages themselves. Are there any questions thus far? Any information that we could present at this point that would be useful to you based on what I've mentioned thus far?
One thing is that the long-term insurance policies are recognizing the needs of individuals who will be needing those services, and they are addressing alternative care to nursing homes.
Yes.
Which has been quite helpful.
Yes. And I think that's a good example of where the timing now to have these sorts of discussions, I think, is incredibly important because the healthcare reform debate, if you could get in under some of the rhetoric, had really a great deal to do about providing healthcare to people over the age 65 or what are called the near elderly. For example, what many people don't know is that one of the biggest insurance-related problems we have in this country is people age 55 to 64. Who have been forced out of the job market or are out of the job market, don't qualify yet for Medicare,
And it's very, very expensive for them to get individual-based health insurance. And so those are sorts of problems that healthcare reform is going to deal with. But there are going to be other issues as well that go back to some of the access and utilization issues. Let me get into that by trying to explore a little bit with you what long-term care policy has been like in this country, because as I mentioned before, it has been relatively haphazard, and I think maybe now is the time to be a little more organized about how we do this. What's really the first federal policy related to aging that we had in this country? Social Security Act in 1935. What was interesting about the Social Security Act was that in terms of defining even something simple like age 65 for the receipt of benefits was a fairly haphazard event. One of the things that happens when states or any government body try to think about developing policy is they go looking around to see what other people had done. And one of the first people to develop any sort of a pension program for the people that worked for them was Bismarck in Germany in the 19th century. And he decided that he was going to provide some sort of a pension policy for his soldiers. And he got together with his folks, and he decided that they would provide benefits to these people when they reached age 65. Well, that was really a smart choice for him at that point, because first of all, hardly anybody lived to age 65. And the people he was going to provide pensions to were soldiers, so that they were even less likely to reach age 65. So that what happened then was that's what really people first looked to as a way, well, how did we come up with age 65? How did we decide that that was an appropriate time for people to start thinking about these sorts of issues? Then in the early 20th century, the union movement in major cities began to think about providing longer-term benefits and more expansive benefits to their people, and they began to be looking around to find out, well, what should we do, what should we provide, and when should we begin to provide it? So a lot of the unions in the early part of this century began to latch on to age 65 as an appropriate chronological marker for providing benefits. Again, at the turn of the century, there were only 1.5 million people over the age of 65. Only 1 in 25 in the entire U.S. population, as opposed to 1 in 8 today and 1 in 4 down the road, were over the age of 65. So it was a fairly easy decision to make. It was a wonderful set of benefits that made people feel very good about what the government was doing, but hardly anybody was going to use them. And so age 65 became an important part of the Social Security Act in 1935. What was the next part of old age policy in the United States that comes to mind?
Medicare.
Medicare and Medicaid in 64, 65. And again, the age 65 marker was used. And if you've ever read any of the material associated with the development of those policies, they never for a moment expected that Medicare and Medicaid would be as expensive as they are. They were already more expensive by 1970 in terms of federal expenditures, and in the case of Medicaid, in terms of the state allocation to that as well. They were more expensive than they ever imagined. What was really the next sort of effort at long-term care policy or age-related policy in this country? Any of you remember the Catastrophic Care Act? 1989, 1990. Well, that was a very interesting thing, and I really think goes at some of the issues that are tied centrally to the concerns that I have and that I hope that we can talk about. And that is that the catastrophic care policy was specifically designed to provide an acceptable level of care for everybody over the age of 65. What it was going to mean, however, was that depending on whose numbers you looked at, somewhere between the top 5 or top 15 wealthiest people over age 65, we're going to have to pay a little more for Medicare. And they didn't like that at all. My brother-in-law is from Chicago, and many of you may remember pictures of Dan Rostenkowski, the congressman from Chicago, being chased down the boulevard by older people with umbrellas, saying that this was not something that they were interested in. And in fact, they came back from a winter recess, and they did away with it, and they didn't pursue that. So catastrophic care policy was really the next effort to do that. And now we're in a situation where healthcare reform, although nobody's really talking about
or nobody talked last year about healthcare reform in an aging-specific context. It really was a great deal about what are we going to do with the near elderly specifically, but also as that has moved into now in the Contract of America and the discussions that are now going on in Congress, talking about how we're going to modify Medicare and also modify Medicaid in a way that is going to dramatically impact people over the age of 65. And again, I'll argue anything that affects people over the age of 65 affects all of us, not just because we pay taxes, but because we're all going to be affected, because what the government doesn't do, we're going to have to do. And that's one of the things that we need to understand about age-related policy in this country. That is that we know, and we can actually go to subcommittee reports from the U.S. Congress from the late 70s and early 80s, we know that politicians are more than hesitant to provide new money for the health and welfare, social welfare benefits of people over the age 65, because they believe that they would just be paying for something that families either should do or are doing, and therefore they don't see a net gain. And that's something that I think is problematic, because we're talking about numbers and we're talking about impacts on people that go well beyond what they used to be. And that's part of what we need to understand, that times have changed a great deal. Let me indicate to you, one of my jobs is to tell you what resources are available to you should you be interested in reading this week on these and related issues. One book that's available in the bookstore to you, the paperback version, is called Having Our Say. If you've not read this book or are not familiar with it from the many radio programs and even a couple of public TV programs about these individuals, you really ought to read it. It really is terrific. It's a terrific way to understand that people live in different circumstances. Having Our Say is by the Delaney sisters. When it was published in 1993, I think it was Sadie was 101, Bessie was 104. Their parents were slaves. I think it was Sadie was a dentist, Bessie was a nurse, never married. It's a marvelous collection of their thoughts and their experiences about a life that certainly is not one that I'm familiar with, but is one that is very familiar to many people like us who just happen to be of a different age or a different gender or a different color. So Having Our Say is something that if you're looking for, it's often quite entertaining. Has anybody read this? It's often quite entertaining. It's also very, very informative. Another book that's available in the bookstore is called The Age Wave. And some of you may be familiar with this, a book that came out a few years ago by Ken Dykewall. And really what he does is take some of the demographic and economic issues that I just briefly touched upon and talks about what their impacts will be in many, many different areas of life, from family relationships all the way to and through environmental kinds of things, the marketplace, the economy, and all of those sorts of things. So you might find this useful if you're interested in some of that. I will occasionally throughout this week make reference to other kinds of resources that are available, because again, I think that one of the things that occurs is we are not all of us well enough aware about the resources that are out there, and we could perhaps benefit by doing that. One of the things that I have here that you're welcome to refer to at any time if you have some specific issue that you want to pursue, that you want to when you go home, is called the National Directory for Elder Care Information and Referral. It's the 1993-94 Directory of State and Area Agencies on Aging. Many of you probably know that the Administration on Aging and the federal government emanates out through all of the states, and that all of you live in a place that has what's called an Area Agency on Aging. And those are tremendous resources to you, because what they do is work to coalesce the social, health, and economic resources in that particular area for you, if you're someone over the age of 65, or for you if you're someone that's trying to acquire information or provide assistance to someone over the age of 65. And so you're welcome to look at this, but that's something that you need to know, that there are tremendous resources out there accessible to you, and that these things can be even done over long distances.
That's a federal resource?
This document is a federal resource. Yeah, yeah.
Does that have the national 800 number?
I think it does. That's a very good
800
But another easier look
call your local United Way.
That's right.
They're information referral lines, and they can connect you right in your community as to who provides those services in your geographic area.
Right. What this book does, if you take a look at it, for example, if you're from North Dakota, it shows you the map, county map of North Dakota, and it shows you what the areas are for that area. I didn't see the 800 number real quickly, but I'll look again to see if it's in there. So these are the kinds of resources in contacting the United Way and that sort of thing. A book that's available free, and I brought several here, but there's a tremendous amount of information available from the American Association of Retired Persons. One of the reasons that I grabbed this one and had several copies sent up, I have some here and there, some in the library, is that this really, the title of this is Aging of the U.S. Population, but the subtitle is Economic and Environmental Implications. And I am aware, although this is my first year, I am aware that environmental issues are of great concern to people who have been at Holden and who come to Holden regularly. And I think it's worth some discussion, or at least your reading at some point, to think through what might be the environmental implications of a society that is increasingly aging, and how are we going to keep up with their needs, and what is that going to cause us to do environmentally. The other kinds of documents, which would be much more specific to any concern that you would have or questions that you would have, but our federal government is actually doing a nice job through the National Institutes of Health these days in putting together what they call expert panels. An expert, one of the things that you may well know is that you go to a physician for a specific health problem, and you've read and they tell you that there are 400 different ways to solve the problem, and it depends on which study you look at to know which one would be best for you. What these expert panels are all about is getting people together for several days over usually a year, experts in various areas, like in this case cataract, in this case depression, in this case prostate cancer, and we have another book that we just haven't found the right box yet on urinary incontinence. But an expert panel that gets together to talk about what are the best ways that we have to deal with these problems so that you and I can free then get these books and look through them so that at least it may be just information for us. At best, it might make us better informed so that when we go talk to our physicians, and that's a great deal of what's happening, is it's empowering people so that they can go to their physicians and clinicians and talk to them about what some of the alternatives might be. Again, urinary incontinence becomes a good example because most people believe that the best resolution, if there is a resolution, is surgery. In fact, we now know that surgery may be effective or useful in less than half of situations, and in many of those it may not even be clinically called for. But there are a number of behavioral management kinds of things that an individual can do on their own with some training that would bring about a much better result. This is by the National Institutes of Health, and they're called Clinical Practice Guidelines. So they're intended both for you as a layperson, essentially, to learn more about particular kinds of problems. But they're also, in an ideal world, meant for physicians and nurses and others to become familiar with this material as well, because even when they're first published, they are regularly updated. So I don't know if it's true of any of these three that I happen to have here, but for some of the clinical practice guidelines, they're already in a revision because they want to keep up to date on the information. Okay.
How are those available?
These are available. Actually, there are addresses here, but there are also, again, if I don't readily find them here, I'll bring the 800 number on Thursday. But the easiest way to acquire them is they have an 800 number and a clearinghouse, and you just call up, and there's a... I called them in March, I think, and at that time they had 15 or 16 different clinical practice guidelines on different topics that you could look into.
Is there a fee then for these books?
There is not. These are absolutely free.
Really?
Yeah. And that's
all
the kind of thing.
Should have them in their offices,
well,
too.
All good doctors should have them in their office, although I can tell you from at least the experience of one person who I had sent one of these clinical practice guidelines because they were going to see a physician in a couple of weeks about a particular condition, read the book, felt at the very least that they were more prepared to ask questions and things like that, and found that at one point the physician began to ask, well, how do you know all this? And she said, well, you know, I read these clinical practice guidelines. And it really
felt to the physician apparently that there was some bit of being threatened in terms of who was the purveyor of the information and all of that sort of thing. And so I think that's something that you need to be aware of. I mean, we all believe that we know our professions best, and sometimes there can be that, but I think most of us would argue that having the information is better than not having the information. And we can get lists of all of this sort of thing.
There's also a book out. It's called Best Bills and Worst Bills. It's by NADA. Is it NADA? But it does cost, I think, $12.
Okay.
But it gives you all the side effects on any interaction with other medicines.
Great. There are also some very good computer programs out now. And they're often used in hospitals. Pharmacists certainly use them where, mm-hmm. but now they're I don't know the dollar amount, but they're now becoming inexpensive enough that you could, for you or for anyone else, I mean, the average person over the age of 65 takes 5 prescriptions. Mm-hmm. The opportunity for interactions are large because many people over the age 65 are seeing more than one physician, and I've been in homes with medical residents and with nurse practitioners and others where they'll go through the medications and it turns out people are taking 7 or 8 things, some of which overlap, some of which have expired, some of which shouldn't be taken with each other. And again, that's an area where we should just be more individually well informed so that we can play a role for ourselves and for the people that we're trying to be useful for in this environment. Any other questions at this point? Well, I think what I'd like to do is on Thursday, we'll spend our time going through the title for Thursday is Aging, Health, and Social Justice. And really what I want to pursue on Thursday is the notion that this really is about social justice. It really is about understanding that the people on the left-hand side of this continuum are in really a different situation and are a different sort of person in the same way that we think about other social problems. And I want to explore what some of those issues are. And I specifically want to spend some time on Thursday thinking through and talking about the issue of if we're relying on family for 80% of the long-term care provided in this country, what is the impact of doing that? And how can we mediate that impact? Is there a role for people like you and I to play? And is there a role for churches to play in helping people through those sorts of situations? I thought I would close today. There is another book by the Delaney sisters that just came out a year ago called The Book of Everyday Wisdom. And you're welcome to borrow my copy if you want. This one we don't have in the library. But Bessie, who I think now is 103.
Are they still alive?
They are still alive.
We have a friend that's 103 and one.
Are they using a word processor?
Actually, these are written with a woman named Amy Hill Harth, who I believe came to know them. I think the jacket of the first book that is available in the library, she came to know them by interacting with them. I think she may be a social worker or some, I don't remember exactly her role, but she came to know them through that sort of contact and then began to work with them on these books. But Bessie, who is 103, is the person who wrote this little section. Some people, older people especially, tend to draw into themselves. They're afraid of getting to know their neighbors or they're not interested. They grow isolated. That's a big mistake. You never know when you might need other people, but you need to earn their help. You have to contribute to your community. Papa taught us that. He was so thoughtful that even if it was cheaper to go someplace else, he shopped locally. Even in the days when a few cents made a big difference, supporting our neighbors was more important than money. The Bible says you should love all your neighbors. Sometimes that's not easy. The worst are folks who are noisy but don't share a thing about themselves. We had a woman like that living near us once. She'd come right out and ask you anything, put you on the spot, store up opinions about you. Sadie just stayed away from her, but she drove me wild. Of course, I can be a little nosy and opinionated too. A little nosiness can be a good thing. We've been retired a long time, so we're home all day, and our neighbors are glad to have us keeping an eye on the street. Like if we notice strange cars or people who don't belong in someone's yard. Chances are they're up to no good. We belong to what they call a neighborhood watch, and if we see something fishy, we go for help. Some working parents nearby don't want their kids home alone after school. Who can blame them? So we help out by having the children stop off with us.
One child would do her homework on our dining room table until her folks got home. And one day she got stuck on her arithmetic. So I said, bring it over here. Maybe I can help you. Why, that child was so surprised, she just couldn't imagine that two old ladies like us could know arithmetic. Well, we showed her what to do, and the lesson she got that day was a lot more valuable than arithmetic. She learned to be more open-minded about people, not to assume, not to judge. So we do our little bit. Getting involved is satisfying. It keeps us busy and makes us useful. Everyone has something to contribute. They really are good books, and I'd encourage you to pick the one up in the library that's there and borrow this one if you would like. Thank you very much, and if you're able, I hope that you will join us on Thursday at 3:50.